It has been a rough couple of years for the publishing industry, but things would have been far worse were it not for romance fiction. Sales in that genre have held pretty steady, more than $1 billion last year. And one of the brightest spots has been romances aimed at ethnic readers. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates has the story.
Welcome to the annual convention of Romance Writers of America. RWA is the trade association devoted to the care and advocacy of romance writers everywhere. And while you might think romances are all about porcelain-skinned women who are clasped by their narrow waist to a rock-hard hero's sun-bronzed chest, not anymore. Proof of that is this year's recipient of RWA's Lifetime Achievement Award. By this year's end, Brenda Jackson will have had 96 of her African-American romance novels published.
I'm set to publish my 100th book in November 2013.
Jackson was the first black romance author to make the New York Times bestseller list. And unlike Danielle Steele, who writes popular romances from a hilltop mansion, Jackson, until she retired, wrote as she juggled her day job and family obligations.
I used to get up 3 o'clock in the morning and write my stories and then go to work. Take my kids to ball practice, whatever, and sit in the car and do my editing then. And still take care of my husband at night. And when he go to sleep, I'm back at my computer.
Jackson says she's loved romantic stories since she was in middle school, except for this.
None of those people look like me, and that's why I wrote my own stories. That's why in the eighth grade, I wanted to write stories that look like me.
Doing that has made Brenda Jackson a consistent bestseller. Black women snap up her books. Sometimes so do their men, because Jackson likes to write steamy romances.
I pretty much go into the bedroom. I don't just close the door and let the readers wonder what goes on, but I do it tastefully.
No 50 Shades here, which, by the way, is romance, kinky division. Like Brenda Jackson, Michelle Mankou is African American, and she's a past president of RWA. Mankou says Terry McMillan's 1996 bestseller, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, brought black romance to the general public's attention. It was an indication of how the market could expand.
It gave mainstream publishers a peek into the appetite of readers. Then the mainstream got interested and presented imprints for it.
Eventually, many of the genre's major publishers signed black writers, but getting published was just the first challenge. Getting a good spot in bookstores was the next. Michelle Mankou says the rise of e-books has reduced that obstacle considerably.
You don't have to wait for the validation or confirmation from marketing teams, because I feel the marketing in the publishing houses try to determine what the reader's appetite will be. And I think they're underestimating the sophistication of romance readers.
The success of the early African-American writers spawned writers of other ethnicities. Latinas, Asians, and Native Americans have all written romances, and many have fans outside their respective ethnic communities. Cami Tang, a bubbly young woman with fuchsia-streaked hair, is autographing her books out on the cavernous signing floor. Tang says her parents were okay when she wanted to ditch a career in biology to write Christian-themed romances.
They're so proud of me that I was able to succeed in a business that's so difficult, especially for people in minorities.
Tang's latest novel is Protection for Hire.
The heroine is the niece of the Japanese mafia boss in San Francisco, and she works for him, but she went to jail for her cousin for a murder she didn't commit, and then she finds Jesus in jail.
Tang's heroine is released eventually, but her uncle wants her to go back to her old job immediately. But she can't. She's been saved. Her happily ever after, or HEA as they say around here, comes with a former adversary, the lawyer who put her away. The romance industry's HEA may come as an increasingly diverse group of writers swells its sails. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Let's begin another chapter in our series Crime in the City, about crime writers and the places where their mysteries are set. I recently spent a day exploring the dark side of a sunny city, Honolulu, on the lush green island of Oahu. It's here that author Victoria Nalani Newbel takes readers back to the Hawaii of the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
Waikiki was already a tourist paradise with Hawaiian surfers riding the waves and mainlanders sunning on the sand, much like this beach where Victoria Newble introduces us to a more sinister Hawaii.
I think that juxtaposition between things that are horrible and terrible happening in a beautiful setting adds a lot of tension and depth to things.
Her first novel, Murder Casts a Shadow, could have been written in the 1930s. It's an old-fashioned whodunit where all the characters are linked as they come together to put on a play for Honolulu's community theater. Only the playwright is not from here. He's Ned Minucia, writer and sometimes spy, son of a British aristocrat and a Samoan princess raised in England. In short, the type of outsider with an exotic past and a taste for adventure that has always been drawn to the islands. On his first day, Ned wakes up in an elegant guest house above a lake of clouds, as Newble describes it in her book.
His imagination always seemed more alive in Hawaii. He could relax. He wasn't the oddity that he was in London, or the oddity he felt he'd become in his birthplace. Honolulu was a mixture of all kinds of odd people and things. Floating in the ocean between so many worlds.
The darkly handsome Ned will soon team up with Mina Beckwith, girl reporter for the Honolulu Bulletin. With her flowing dark hair, green eyes, and golden brown skin, Mina is a tropical Nancy Drew, always on the lookout for a mystery in search of a sleuth.
She's part Hawaiian. She was born here in Honolulu, and she lives on this beach.
Like her character, Mina, Victoria Newble is descended partly from native Hawaiians. And this particular stretch of beach actually played a part in what for Hawaiians is a tragic moment in their history. In the late 19th century, a group of powerful white landowners and businessmen, with the help of U.S. troops, overthrew the Kingdom of Hawaii. And it was here, shortly after, that a boat full of Hawaiians tried to take it back.
This was the beach where they landed arms that they had shipped in from San Francisco. You know, there's a part in my book where Ned says to Mina, "Oh, you're living in rebel territory." And she goes, "Yes, I am, on the beach at Ka'alawai."
This is one of the many moments where Victoria Newble threads Hawaii's sometimes painful past into the story. It's a history largely unknown to the tourists enjoying the island's charms, giving depth to what would otherwise be just a fun beach read. Still, this is a murder mystery, so from Rebel Beach, we move on to a place back in the 30s where a lot of characters were up to no good, Honolulu's public market in the heart of Chinatown.
When people want something really fresh, this is where they come.
These fish are so fresh, they're flopping.
Our Chinatown in the city is one of the oldest in the nation. I set a lot of scenes and action in Chinatown because it used to have a reputation of being super seedy, and there's still a lot of gambling going on here today, and a lot of shady deals are done in Chinatown.
One such deal might have gotten a character killed in Murder Casts a Shadow. It involves the illegal trade in Asian antiquities passing through the secretive underworld of 1930s Chinatown. The actual murder was in the museum, Honolulu's Bishop Museum. Founded in the 1880s, its cool, dark Victorian interior overflows with the precious artifacts of Hawaii's long-gone kings and queens. It looks exactly as described in the book.
Ancient Hawaiian gods hewn from stone or wood stood silent and staring. Their large carved features seemed to be reaching out as if they were trying to say something. Ned felt them touching him in a way that was both all too familiar and always unfathomable. He looked into the standing glass cases that lined the walls, a carved bowl decorated with inserts of teeth, a large gourd believed to have held the winds. What a marvelous world these things came from, Ned thought.
In a sense, these artifacts take their revenge. When Mina shows up at the museum to do a story about several portraits of Hawaii's last royal rulers, the man she comes to interview won't be talking, because he's dead.
Abel Halpern is the first victim in Murder Casts a Shadow, and he is the curator of the Bishop Museum. And his body is discovered in the basement of the Bishop Museum. He's whacked on the head with an artifact from the collection on his office shelf.
That first murder of a widely loathed and possibly crooked curator leads Mina and Ned to a deeper, older mystery hidden in the royal portraits. What or who killed Hawaii's last king? The historical record says Kalakaua fell ill and died on a royal trip to San Francisco. Victoria Newble has heard a different version, passed down through generations of Hawaiians, that the king was murdered.
When I was young, my grandmother and an old friend of hers used to get together and play canasta every week. And sometimes they would stop and they would tell stories about the monarchy. And that's where I first heard that rumor that the king might have been poisoned. It was really interesting to listen to this one woman who we called Nana, because whenever she talked about the overthrow of the monarchy, her voice got really quiet. It was charged with emotion. So that left a really big impression on me.
A sense that it's the lost world of old Hawaii that casts a shadow.
You know, that history for so long was kept away from people, at least in my generation. And I realized that by writing these mysteries, you can kind of go home again. And you can take other people with you. I think that's the magic of writing. You know, you can actually take somebody to a different place.
And Victoria Nalani Newble's Hawaii is a place where two island sleuths uncover betrayal and murder among the fragrant breezes and turquoise sea. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green.
When she was just 5 years old, writer Vade Ratner's comfortable and protected life as the child of an aristocratic Cambodian family ended abruptly. That's when Khmer Rouge soldiers banged on the gates of the family's compound and ordered them to leave. It was the start of a reign of terror by the Khmer Rouge. It left hundreds of thousands of Cambodians dead, including Ratner's entire family except her mother. Ratner has written a new book about her experience, and it's not a memoir. It's a work of fiction. Because, as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, Ratner believes stories helped her to survive.
Vade Ratner always felt like an oddball as a child. She was self-conscious because she walked with a limp as a result of polio. One day, some of the kids in her extended family were teasing her, saying she was not one of them, that she must have been found in the street. Ratner ran to her father for comfort.
He said, you know, they were probably right. I did find you, and I found you in a bird's nest. You wobbled when you walk, but, you know, there are these things, these wings that's coming out of your back. And, you know, I looked at him skeptically, and he said to me, well, you know, that's what I dreamt.
Ratner loved the way her father could transform reality through storytelling. So when it came to writing her first book, In the Shadow of the Banyan, Ratner didn't want to merely chronicle events. She wanted to create a work of art.
I wanted to tell a larger story about hope and survival, the unbreakable bonds of family, and I actually want to tell a story about the power of storytelling to transcend suffering. Because it was the stories that saved me, the stories, the poetry that my father left behind.
Ratner has changed some of the details of her own experiences, the order of events, the size of her family. The young girl in the novel, Rami, is a couple of years older than she was. And the father in the book is a real poet, not just an avid storyteller who loved to recite poetry. But the chaos and violence of her family's forced exile in rural Cambodia is based on what really happened. The reader sees it through the eyes of a child.
What I wanted was for the readers to feel the helplessness of a child, to not understand what was going on, I want the readers' experiences to mirror mine when I went through it.
Rami, and I guess you, I don't know if this really parallels something that really happened, but Rami believes it's her fault that she has lost her father to the Khmer Rouge at a certain point because she inadvertently revealed who he was.
Yes. I I think it's part of why I wrote this book. I think a part of me felt that I was responsible for the loss of my father's life. So I wrote this book to make him live again and to make him live forever.
Ratner says writing this book was excruciating at times because it brought back so many painful memories, including her last moments with her father. In this scene, he tells her that he wants his stories to give her the wings she needs to rise above anything that might happen to her.
I'm telling you this now, this story, for it is a story, so that you will live. When I lie buried beneath this earth, you will fly. For me, Rami, for your papa, you will soar. I didn't respond. I wanted him to stop talking. Whatever it was he was trying to tell me, it sounded like a goodbye.
If her father gave her the inspiration to live, Ratner says it was her mother who ensured that she would survive. Surrounded by death, brutalized by the Khmer Rouge guards, forced into hard labor, and facing starvation, Ratner says her mother did everything she could to protect her only surviving child.
I've always thought of this book as the first half was focused on my father, was almost a love letter to him. And the second half was a celebration of my mother's strength, the transformation that she manifested for me from this woman who depended so much on my father to this woman of amazing strength who charted her own way through this very harsh landscape.
When things become unbearable for Rami, she clings to her father's stories and her mother's words. "You mustn't think this is our life," her mother told her. "Remember who you are."
In a whirl of senseless death, I didn't see the purpose, couldn't grasp the meaning. If this was our collective karma, then why was I still alive? If anything, I was as guilty as those who survived and as innocent as those who died. What name, then, can I give to the force that carried me on? With each life taken away, a part of it passed on to me. I didn't know its name. All I could grasp was the call to remember. Remember, I lived by this word alone.
Ultimately, Ratner and her mother escaped Cambodia and made their way to the United States. While in high school, she was profoundly influenced by the works of Elie Wiesel. She realized she wanted to write about her experience under the Khmer Rouge so that such atrocities might not happen again.
In order to prevent it, we can only be vigilant. We have to recognize that there is both the capacity for good and for atrocity in each and every one of us. When we recognize this, then I think we are much more vigilant that it can happen, not just in a culture like Cambodia. It can happen anywhere.
Looking at Vidae Ratner now, it's almost impossible to believe that this tiny, delicate woman who still walks with a limp could have survived the killing fields of Cambodia. But she did. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green.
Almost everything you know about Batman, the cape, the mask, Gotham, Bruce Wayne, etc., almost all of it is because of one man. And that man is not Bob Kane, who is credited as the writer behind the iconic superhero. Now, if you've seen The Dark Knight Rises, there it is in the credits, based on the character by Bob Kane. The name not there is that of Bill Finger. He's the subject of a new picture book called Bill the Boy Wonder, the secret co-creator of Batman, written by Mark Tyler Nobleman, who joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So who was Bill Finger? Tell me about him.
Bill Finger is the uncredited co-creator of Batman. His name never appeared on a Batman story in his lifetime, but he was responsible for just about everything enduring about Batman. I challenge people to name something about Batman that didn't come from Bill, and most of the time, no matter whether you're a hardcore fan or a person on the street, whatever you say first will be a Bill Finger contribution.
Okay, we all know about Bob Kane, the guy who we're led to believe is the sole creator of Batman, but let me test you on that. Gotham City.
Bill Finger named it.
He named it. He created Gotham City.
Bill Finger named Gotham City.
Bruce Wayne.
He named Bruce Wayne.
Batman, the actual Batman character.
Bill designed the costume. Even though he's the writer, he also was the visual architect. Bob Kane admitted that and explained that in detail.
Bob Kane came up with the idea for a Batman.
Well, even that is disputed. Bob said that he came up with the name Batman, and there are some that feel he didn't even do that much, that his character was called Birdman, and it was actually Bill who said, let's go with Batman.
Okay, what about Robin?
Bill was the one who said Batman needs a needs someone to talk to. Hmm. And as a writer myself, that makes perfect sense. When you're writing a character who's alone all the time, that's very difficult. So Bill said he needs someone to talk to, and through that, Robin evolved. And Bill wrote the first Robin story.
The Joker?
Bill, well, that's also hotly disputed. It was definitely a group effort, but I give Bill a lot of the majority of the credit. He wrote the first story. He came up with the look, although someone else drew it. And I would give Bill more than half the credit for
that. Okay, the thing about Batman that was revolutionary at the time was that he was not born with these superhero powers, these otherworldly powers like Superman. He was just a regular human being who worked out and worked his mind and became a superhero. And that was because of this backstory, because Bruce Wayne as a kid sees his parents get killed by a mugger.
Yes. Yeah, actually, that is what I attribute to Batman's longevity, is the fact that Bill added what was considered a novelistic background.
This was Bill Finger came up with that story.
Bill Finger came up with that story, and that was unprecedented at the time. Most comic book characters before Batman had no real reason to do what they're doing. They were just doing good for good's sake. But Batman had a psychological reason, and that was more depth than anyone had ever applied to a comic book character before.
How did Bill Finger hook up with Bob Kane, the guy who is credited as the person behind Batman?
Bob and Bill actually both went to the same high school, DeWitt Clinton in the Bronx, but they apparently did not know each other there. They met at a party in 1938, which was 5 years after Bill graduated. And Bob was already working for the company that became DC Comics, doing smaller stories. And he saw Bill's potential and had Bill write stories for him.
This is in the late 1930s.
This was probably about 1938. And then Batman debuted in 1939.
And what was the agreement between them? I mean, Bob Kane said, listen, write this stuff for me, and by the way, you're not going to get credit?
Well, unfortunately, no known documentation survives between the two of them. These were young guys. This was an era when there wasn't such an awareness of creators' rights, so they probably didn't sit down and write anything down for posterity. There was no contract. But apparently, Bob did say to Bill, we're going to do this character for DC, you'll write it, I'll have my name on it, and that'll be the arrangement. And Bill agreed, partly because that's what was done at the time, but also partly because it was the end of the Depression, and if you could get any work in your chosen field in the arts, you'd take it.
So he kind of just accepted this.
He did accept it, one of his fatal flaws.
Your book, I should mention, it's not a nonfiction narrative. It is a graphic, essentially a picture book.
Well, it's both. I call it a picture book for older readers. It looks more like a picture book than a traditional graphic novel, but it's got elements of both.
Why did you decide to do it this way rather than writing a straightforward biography?
I wanted to start on the ground level. I wanted people to grow up knowing the story behind Batman. So I wanted it to be accessible to young people, but also be engaging for an older audience.
So Bill Finger has been mentioned before. There were articles about him toward the end of his life. He died in 1974. But to this day, he is not credited as the co-creator, right? If you see the recent movie, the Christopher Nolan movie, mm-hmm. Bob Kane is still credited at the end of that movie.
Yes, Bob Kane is the only person credited on any Batman story in any medium. DC Comics doesn't officially credit Bill Finger as a co-creator, but they do credit him as a writer for any story that he wrote that they reprint. But, for example, The Dark Knight, well, all three of the Christopher Nolan movies take a lot of their influence from Bill Finger, but they don't put his name in the credits on any level. They won't say based on material written by Bill Finger. They don't even say that The Dark Knight was first used in a story that Bill Finger wrote. They should have done.
Why don't they do that?
Anything they do that edges toward giving Bill official credit will raise the red flag to the Kane estate. And they have a contract with the Kane estate, and they don't want to jeopardize that.
The Christopher Nolan Batman is the Bill Finger Batman.
I would say so.
We don't know for sure, but we have to assume that Bob Kane or his family made a lot of money off Batman.
Yes.
Did Bill Finger?
No, Bill made almost nothing. He literally died alone, poor. I mean, poor isn't probably an understatement. He really was living paycheck to paycheck, and even that was a stretch, and unheralded. No obituary ran for him. He didn't have a funeral, and he doesn't even have a gravestone. It's a heartbreaking end to a man who created such a cultural force. There are royalties being paid out to his family after the fact, but that's for reprints. It's not what I call Batman money with all caps. It's not a share of the profit of Batman. It's money for his stories, which is great, but not nearly enough.
When you kind of put it all into perspective, do you see villains in the Bill Finger story, you know, in a way that you would see them in a Batman story, or is it more complicated than that, just like Batman is?
Well, you know, it's an easy parallel to make, and it comes up almost all the time when I speak. And Bob Kane is clearly a villain here, but Bill is not blameless. As I said at the beginning, one of his flaws, and we all have them, was that he did not stand up for himself in the way that a lot of people today think he should have. But that's using a modern hindsight. You can't always do that. It's not always fair to apply what would happen today to what happened 70 years ago.
Mark Tyler Nobleman is the author of the new picture book. It's called Bill the Boy Wonder, the secret co-creator of Batman. Mark, thanks.
Thanks, Guy. I appreciate it.
Novels based on the love lives of well-known cultural figures have been popular in recent years. There was The Paris Wife, about Ernest Hemingway's first marriage. And now a new novel, The Age of Desire, tells the story of Edith Wharton's love affair with a young journalist in Paris. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, the affair is seen in part through the eyes of a devoted companion who's gotten scant attention until now.
Jenny Fields was well into her novel about Edith Wharton when she heard that a new cache of Wharton letters had been discovered. They were written to Anna Bauman, who was Wharton's governess as a child and later became her literary secretary. Bauman had never been considered a major influence on Wharton, but Fields had decided to make her a central character in her book. She felt certain that Wharton and Bauman had a strong relationship.
After all, they had been together for a great part of Edith's life, and I knew they had to have been close. So I imagined that was true, but when the letters came out and supported it at all, it was eerie and thrilling at the same time.
Fields got in touch with Irene Goldman Price, a Wharton scholar, who was editing the letters for a collection called My Dear Governess. The two bonded over their love of Wharton. Goldman Price was fascinated by the fictional world Fields was creating.
I love it. First of all, her imagination makes these people come alive in my mind in ways that they had not before.
These people are, first and foremost, Edith Wharton, who, says Goldman Price, was just coming into her own at the age of 45 as the novel begins.
She has just finally made a success of writing, which is something that she's wanted to do since she was at least 12 years old. In 1905, The House of Mirth comes out. It is not her first novel, but it is her first truly successful novel. She's really feeling her oats.
Enter Morton Fullerton, a young journalist Wharton met while living in Paris. Though he traveled in sophisticated circles, Fullerton wasn't particularly remarkable, but he was charming. And, says Fields, he had a dubious reputation.
He was very drawn, apparently, to power and success. He had had affairs with other successful people, both men and women. He was something of a sociopath because he would have these affairs and then he would just disappear. It was his M.O.
Watching from the sidelines in Fields' version of the story was Anna Bauman. Devoted to both Wharton and her husband, Bauman is stunned as Wharton plunges headlong into her affair with Fullerton.
She's the person who can see it with, I don't want to say cold eyes because she wasn't cold at all, but with clear eyes and see what was going on and understand how Edith was affecting her own sense of right and wrong by what she was doing.
After years of a loveless marriage, Wharton experienced real passion for the first time with Fullerton. When he disappears, she becomes obsessed. In a letter to the writer Henry James, which Fields weaves into the story, Wharton pleads with him to find out what has become of her lover.
Dearest H.J., I beg of you, I urge you to help me. I don't know what's happened to Morton. He's broken my heart with his inability, or perhaps I should say refusal, to answer any of my posts. What could be hampering him? Do you know if he is ill, or has he found someone else to love? Has he written to you this summer? Would he tell you if it were so? I am at wit's end. I am désolée.
During this time, says Goldman Price, Wharton's real letters to Anna Bauman are filled with mundane news, as if she doesn't want her old governess to know what's really happening. She poured out her true feelings in her diary and in a flurry of missives to Fullerton.
She writes letters to him in which she just abases herself and twists herself into a pretzel, promising that I'll be this way or I won't be that way. I can barely read that diary and those letters. But, you know, love is love, and I guess I've seen it happen often enough that I'm not terribly surprised, but it's so painful because she's a genius.
As painful as Wharton's affair with Fullerton was, Jenny Fields believes it was something the writer had to experience.
In the past, when she thought about people in love, there was sort of a cold wall there. You just didn't feel that she really understood that. Even when she writes Age of Innocence afterwards, you just get the understanding of love, obsession, longing that I don't think she understood until she experienced it herself.
In The Age of Desire, Anna Bauman serves as Wharton's conscience, but the beloved governess was powerless to save the great writer from herself. Their friendship was strained, but in the end, Field says, their affection for each other survived and proved stronger than the passionate affair that drove them apart. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.